to journalism and enjoyed a considerable private income. Lastly, he was a charming fellow and showed that he was not lacking in intelligence, for as soon as he made up his mind to be a sleeping partner in the opera, he selected the best possible active manager and went straight to Firmin Richard. Firmin Richard was a very distinguished composer who had published a number of successful pieces of all kinds and who liked nearly every form of music and every sort of musician. Clearly, therefore, it was the duty of every sort of musician to like Monsieur Firmin Richard. The only things to be said against him were that he was rather masterful in his ways and endowed with a very hasty temper. The first few days which the partners spent at the opera were given over to the delight of finding themselves the head of so magnificent an enterprise, and they had forgotten all about that curious, fantastic story of the ghost, when an incident occurred that proved to them that the joke, if joke it were, was not over. Monsieur Firmin Richard reached his office that morning at 11 o'clock. His secretary, Monsieur Remy, showed him half a dozen letters which he had not opened because they were marked private. One of the letters had at once attracted Richard's attention, not only because the envelope was addressed in red ink, but because he seemed to have seen the writing before. He soon remembered that it was the red handwriting in which the memorandum book had been so curiously completed. He recognized the clumsy, childish hand. He opened the letter and read, "Dear Mr. Manager, I am sorry to have to trouble you at a time when you must be so very busy renewing important engagements, signing fresh ones, and generally displaying your excellent taste. I know what you have done for Carlotta, Sorelli, and Little Jam, and for a few others whose admirable qualities of talent or genius you have suspected. Of course, when I use these words, I do not mean to apply them to La Carlotta, who sings like a squirt and who ought never to have been allowed to leave the Ambassadeur and the Café Jacquin, nor to La Sorelli, who owes her success mainly to the coach-builders, nor to Little Jam, who dances like a calf in a field. And I am not speaking of Christine Daae, either, though her genius is certain, whereas your jealousy prevents her from creating any important part. When all is said, you are free to conduct your little business as you think best, are you not? All the same, I should like to take advantage of the fact that you have not turned Christine Daae out of doors by hearing her this evening in the part of Sibel, as that of Margarita has been forbidden her since her triumph of the other evening, and I will ask you not to dispose of my box today nor on the following days, for I cannot end this letter without telling you how disagreeably surprised I have been once or twice to hear, on arriving at the opera, that my box had been sold at the box office by your orders. I did not protest, first, because I dislike scandal, and second, because I thought that your predecessors, Messieurs Debienne and Poligny, who were always charming to me, had neglected, before leaving, to mention my little fads to you. I have now received a reply from those gentlemen to my letter asking for an explanation, and this reply proves that you know all about my memorandum book and, consequently, that you are treating me with outrageous contempt. If you wish to live in peace, you must not begin by taking away my private box. Believe me to be, dear Mr. Manager, without prejudice to these little observations, your most humble and obedient servant, Opera Ghost." The letter was accompanied by a cutting from the agony column of the Revue Théâtrale, which ran, "O.G., there is no excuse for R&M. We told them and left your memorandum book in their hands. Kind regards." Monsieur Firmin Richard had hardly finished reading this letter when Monsieur Armand Monchamin entered, carrying one exactly similar. They looked at each other and burst out laughing. "They are keeping up the joke," said Monsieur Richard, "but I don't call it funny." "What does it all mean?" asked Monsieur Monchamin. "Do they imagine that because they have been managers of the opera, we are going to let them have a box for an indefinite period?" "I am not in the mood to let myself be laughed at long," said Firmin Richard. "It's harmless enough," observed Armand Monchamin. "What is it they really want? A box for tonight?" Monsieur Firmin Richard told his secretary to send Box 5 on the grand tier to Messieurs Debienne and Poligny if it was not sold. It was not. It was sent off to them. Debienne lived at the corner of the Rue Scribe and the Boulevard des Capucines, Poligny in the Rue Aubert. O Ghost's two letters had been posted at the Boulevard des Capucines post office, as Monchamin remarked after examining the envelopes. "You see," said Richard. They shrugged their shoulders and regretted that two men of that age should amuse themselves with such childish tricks. "They might have been civil for all that," said Moncharmin. "Did you notice how they treat us with regard to Carlotta, Sorelli, and little Jam?" "Why, my dear fellow, these two are mad with jealousy. To think that they went to the expense of an advertisement in the Revue Théâtrale. Have they nothing better to do?" "By the way," said Moncharmin, "they seem to be greatly interested in that little Christine Daae." "You know as well as I do that she has the reputation of being quite good," said Richard. "Reputations are easily obtained," replied Moncharmin. "Haven't I a reputation for knowing all about music? And I don't know one key from another." "Don't be afraid. You never had that reputation," Richard declared. Thereupon he ordered the artists to be shown in, who, for the last 2 hours, had been walking up and down outside the door behind which fame and fortune, or dismissal, awaited them. The whole day was spent in discussing, negotiating, signing, or cancelling contracts, and the two overworked managers went to bed early, without so much as casting a glance at Box 5 to see whether Monsieur Debienne and Monsieur Poligny were enjoying the performance. Next morning, the managers received a card of thanks from the ghost. "Dear Mr. Manager, thanks. Charming evening. Daae exquisite. Choruses want waking up. Carlotta a splendid commonplace instrument. We'll write you soon for the 240,000 francs, or 233,424 francs 70 centimes, to be correct. Messieurs Debienne and Poligny have sent me the 6,575 francs 30 centimes, representing the first 10 days of my allowance for the current year. Their privileges finished on the evening of the 10th inst. Kind regards, O.G. On the other hand, there was a letter from Messieurs Debienne and Poligny. "Gentlemen, we are much obliged for your kind thought of us, but you will easily understand that the prospect of again hearing Faust, pleasant though it is to ex-managers of the opera, cannot make us forget that we have no right to occupy Box 5 on the Grand Tier, which is the exclusive property of him of whom we spoke to you when we went through the memorandum book with you for the last time. See Clause 98, final paragraph. Accept, gentlemen, etc." "Oh, those fellows are beginning to annoy me," shouted Firmin Richard, snatching up the letter. And that evening, Box 5 was sold. The next morning, Monsieur Richard and Moncharmin, on reaching their office, found an inspector's report relating to an incident that had happened the night before in Box 5. I give the essential part of the report. "I was obliged to call in a municipal guard twice this evening to clear Box 5 on the Grand Tier, once at the beginning and once in the middle of the second act. The occupants, who arrived as the curtain rose on the second act, created a regular scandal by their laughter and their ridiculous observations. There were cries of hush all around them, and the whole house was beginning to protest when the box-keeper came to fetch me. I entered the box and said what I thought necessary. The people did not seem to me to be in their right mind, and they made stupid remarks. I said that, if the noise was repeated, I should be compelled to clear the box. The moment I left, I heard the laughing again, with fresh protests from the house. I returned with a municipal guard who turned them out. They protested, still laughing, saying they would not go unless they had their money back. At last they became quiet, and I allowed them to enter the box again. The laughter at once recommenced, and this time I had them turned out definitely. Send for the inspector," said Richard to his secretary, who had already read the report and marked it with blue pencil. Monsieur Remy, the secretary, had foreseen the order and called the inspector at once. "Tell us what happened," said Richard bluntly. The inspector began to splutter and referred to the report. "Well, but what were those people laughing at?" asked Moncharmin. "They must have been dining, sir, and seemed more inclined to lark about than to listen to good music. The moment they entered the box, they came out again and called the box-keeper, who asked them what they wanted. They said, 'Look in the box. There's no one there, is there?' 'No,' said the woman. 'Well,' said they, 'when we went in, we heard a voice saying that the box was taken.'" Monsieur Moncharmin could not help smiling as he looked at Monsieur Richard. But Monsieur Richard did not smile. He himself had done too much in that way in his time not to recognize in the inspector's story all the marks of one of those practical jokes which begin by amusing and end by enraging the victims. The inspector, to curry a favor with Monsieur Moncharmin, who was smiling, thought it best to give a smile too, a most unfortunate smile. Monsieur Richard glared at this subordinate, who thenceforth made it his business to display a face of utter consternation. "However, when the people arrived," roared Richard, "there was no one in the box, was there?" "Not a soul, sir, not a soul, nor in the box on the right, nor in the box on the left. Not a soul, sir, I swear. The box-keeper told it me often enough, which proves that it was all a joke." "Oh, you agree, do you?" said Richard. "You agree, it's a joke, and you think it funny, no doubt." "I think it in very bad taste, sir." "And what did the box-keeper say?" "Oh, she just said that it was the opera ghost. That's all she said." And the inspector grinned. But he soon found that he had made a mistake in grinning, for the words had no sooner left his mouth than Monsieur Richard, from gloomy, became furious. "Send for the box-keeper," he shouted. "Send for her, this minute, and bring her into me here, and turn all those people out." The inspector tried to protest, but Richard closed his mouth with an angry order to hold his tongue. Then, when the wretched man's lips seemed shut forever, the manager commanded him to open them once more. "Who is this opera ghost?" he snarled. But the inspector was by this time incapable of speaking a word. He managed to convey by a despairing gesture that he knew nothing about it, or rather that he did not wish to know. "Have you ever seen him? Have you seen the opera ghost?" The inspector, by means of a vigorous shake of the head, denied ever having seen the ghost in question. "Very well," said Monsieur Richard coldly. The inspector's eyes started out of his head, as though to ask why the manager had uttered that ominous "very well." "Because I'm going to settle the account of anyone who has not seen him," explained the manager. "As he seems to be everywhere, I can't have people telling me that they see him nowhere. I like people to work for me when I employ them." Having said this, Monsieur Richard paid no attention to the inspector and discussed various matters of business with his acting manager, who had entered the room meanwhile. The inspector thought he could go, and was gently, oh so gently, sidling toward the door, when Monsieur Richard nailed the man to the floor with a thundering, "Stay where you are!" Monsieur Remy had sent for the box-keeper to the Rue de Provence, close to the opera, where she was engaged as a porteress. She soon made her appearance. "What's your name?"
"Mame Giry. You know me well enough, sir. I'm the mother of little Giry, little Meg, what?"
This was said in so rough and solemn a tone that, for a moment, Monsieur Richard was impressed. He looked at Mame Giry in her faded shawl, her worn shoes, her old taffeta dress and dingy bonnet. It was quite evident from the manager's attitude that he either did not know or could not remember having met Mame Giry, or even little Giry, nor even little Meg. But Mame Giry's pride was so great that the celebrated box-keeper imagined that everybody knew her. "Never heard of her," the manager declared. "But that's no reason, Mame Giry, why I shouldn't ask you what happened last night to make you and the inspector call in a municipal guard."
"I was just wanting to see you, sir, and talk to you about it, so that you mightn't have the same unpleasantness as Monsieur Debienne and Monsieur Poligny. They wouldn't listen to me either at first."
"I'm not asking you about all that. I'm asking you what happened last night." Mame Giry turned purple with indignation. Never had she been spoken to like that. She rose as though to go, gathering up the folds of her skirt and waving the feathers of her dingy bonnet with dignity. But, changing her mind, she sat down again and said, in a haughty voice,
"I'll tell you what happened. The ghost was annoyed again."
Thereupon, as Monsieur Richard was on the point of bursting out, Monsieur Moncharmin interfered and conducted the interrogatory, whence it appeared that Mame Giry thought it quite natural that a voice should be heard to say that a box was taken when there was nobody in the box. She was unable to explain this phenomenon, which was not new to her, except by the intervention of the ghost. Nobody could see the ghost in his box, but everybody could hear him. She had often heard him, and they could believe her, for she always spoke the truth. They could ask Monsieur Debienne and Monsieur Poligny, and anybody who knew her, and also Monsieur Isidore Sack, who had had a leg broken by the ghost.
"Indeed," said Moncharmin, interrupting her. "Did the ghost break poor Isidore Sack's leg?"
Mame Giry opened her eyes with astonishment at such ignorance. However, she consented to enlighten these two poor innocents. The thing had happened in Monsieur Debienne and Monsieur Poligny's time, also in Box 5, and also during a performance of Faust. Mame Giry coughed, cleared her throat. It sounded as though she were preparing to sing the whole of Gounod's score, and began, "It was like this, sir. That night,
Monsieur Maniera and his lady, the jewellers in the Rue Mogador, were sitting in the front of the box with their great friend Monsieur Isidore Sack, sitting behind Madame Maniera. Mephistopheles was singing. Mame Giry here burst into song herself. "Caterina, while you play at sleeping." And then Monsieur Maniera heard a voice in his right ear. His wife was on his left, saying, "Aha! Julie is not playing at sleeping." His wife happened to be called Julie. So Monsieur Maniera turns to the right to see who was talking to him like that. Nobody there. He rubs his ear and asks himself if he's dreaming. Then Mephistopheles went on with his serenade. "But perhaps I'm boring you, gentlemen." "No, no, go on." "You are too good, gentlemen," with a smirk. Well then, Mephistopheles went on with his serenade. Mame Giry burst into song again. "Saint, unclose thy portals holy, and accord the bliss to a mortal bending lowly of a pardoned kiss." And then Monsieur Maniera again hears the voice in his right ear, saying this time, "Ha-ha! Julie wouldn't mind according a kiss to Isidore." Then he turns around again, but this time to the left. And what do you think he sees? Isidore, who had taken his lady's hand and was covering it with kisses through the little round place in the glove, like this, gentlemen, rapturously kissing the bit of palm left bare in the middle of her thread gloves. Then they had a lively time between them. Bang, bang! Monsieur Maniera, who was big and strong, like you, Monsieur Richard, gave two blows to Monsieur Isidore Sack, who was small and weak, like Monsieur Moncharmin, saving his presence. There was a great uproar. People in the house shouted, "That will do! Stop them! He'll kill him!" Then at last Monsieur Isidore Sack managed to run away. "Then the ghost had not broken his leg?" asked Monsieur Moncharmin, a little vexed that his figure had made so little impression on Mame Giry. "He did break it for him, sir," replied Mame Giry haughtily. "He broke it for him on the grand staircase, which he ran down too fast, sir, and it will be long before the poor gentleman will be able to go up it again." "Did the ghost tell you what he said in Monsieur Maniera's right ear?" asked Monsieur Moncharmin, with a gravity which he thought exceedingly humorous. "No, sir, it was Monsieur Maniera himself, so—" "But you have spoken to the ghost, my good lady." "As I am speaking to you now, my good sir," Mame Giry replied. "And when the ghost speaks to you, what does he say?" "Well, he tells me to bring him a footstool." This time Richard burst out laughing, as did Moncharmin and Rémy, the secretary. Only the inspector, warned by experience, was careful not to laugh, while Mame Giry ventured to adopt an attitude that was positively threatening. "Instead of laughing," she cried indignantly, "you'd do better to do as Monsieur Poligny did, who found out for himself." "Found out about what?" asked Moncharmin, who had never been so much amused in his life. "About the ghost, of course. Look here." She suddenly calmed herself, feeling that this was a solemn moment in her life. "Look here," she repeated. "They were playing La Juive. Monsieur Poligny thought he would watch the performance from the ghost's box. Well, when Leopold cries, 'Let us fly,' you know, and Eliezer stops them and says, 'Whither go ye?' Well, Monsieur Poligny, I was watching him from the back of the next box, which was empty. Monsieur Poligny got up and walked out quite stiffly, like a statue. And before I had time to ask him, 'Whither go ye?' like Eliezer, he was down the staircase, but without breaking his leg." "Still, that doesn't let us know how the opera ghost came to ask you for a footstool," insisted Monsieur Moncharmin. "Well, from that evening, no one tried to take the ghost's private box from him. The manager gave orders that he was to have it at each performance, and whenever he came, he asked me for a footstool." "Tut, tut! A ghost asking for a footstool! Then this ghost of yours is a woman?" "No, the ghost is a man." "How do you know?" "He has a man's voice. Oh, such a lovely man's voice. This is what happens. When he comes to the opera, it's usually in the middle of the first act. He gives three little taps on the door of box five. The first time I heard those three taps, when I knew there was no one in the box, you can think how puzzled I was. I opened the door, listened, looked, nobody. And then I heard a voice say, 'Mame Jules.' My poor husband's name was Jules. 'A footstool, please.' Saving your presence, gentlemen, it made me feel all overish like. But the voice went on, 'Don't be frightened, Mame Jules. I'm the opera ghost.' And the voice was so soft and kind that I hardly felt frightened. The voice was sitting in the corner chair on the right in the front row."
"Was there anyone in the box on the right of box five?" asked Moncharmin.
No. Box 7 and Box 3, the one on the left, were both empty. The curtain had only just gone up.
And what did you do?
Well, I brought the footstool. Of course, it wasn't for himself he wanted it, but for his lady. But I never heard nor saw her.
Eh? What? So now the ghost is married?
The eyes of the two managers travelled from Mame Giry to the inspector, who, standing behind the box-keeper, was waving his arms to attract their attention. He tapped his forehead with a distressful forefinger to convey his opinion that the widow Jules Giry was most certainly mad, a piece of pantomime which confirmed Monsieur Richard in his determination to get rid of an inspector who kept a lunatic in his service. Meanwhile, the worthy lady went on about her ghost, now painting his generosity. At the end of the performance, he always gives me 2 francs, sometimes 5, sometimes even 10, when he has been many days without coming. Only since people have begun to annoy him again, he gives me nothing at all.
"Excuse me, my good woman," said Moncharmin, while Mame Giry tossed the feathers in her dingy hat at this persistent familiarity. "Excuse me, how does the ghost manage to give you 2 francs?
"Why, he leaves them on the little shelf in the box, of course. I find them with the programme, which I always give him. Some evenings I find flowers in the box, a rose that must have dropped from his lady's bodice, for he brings a lady with him sometimes. One day they left a fan behind them."
"Oh, the ghost left a fan, did he? And what did you do with it?"
"Well, I brought it back to the box next night."
Here the inspector's voice was raised.
"You've broken the rules. I shall have to fine you, Mame Giry."
"Hold your tongue, you fool," muttered Monsieur Firmin Richard.
"You brought back the fan, and then?"
"Well, then, they took it away with them, sir. It was not there at the end of the performance, and in its place they left me a box of English sweets, which I'm very fond of. That's one of the ghost's pretty thoughts."
"That will do, Mame Giry. You can go."
When Mame Giry had bowed herself out with the dignity that never deserted her, the manager told the inspector that they had decided to dispense with that old madwoman's services, and when he had gone in his turn, they instructed the acting manager to make up the inspector's accounts. Left alone, the managers told each other of the idea which they both had in mind, which was that they should look into that little matter of Box 5 themselves.
Chapter 5. The Enchanted Violin. Christine Daae, owing to intrigues to which I will return later, did not immediately continue her triumph at the opera. After the famous gala night, she sang once at the Duchess de Zurich's, but this was the last occasion on which she was heard in private. She refused, without plausible excuse, to appear at a charity concert to which she had promised her assistance. She acted throughout as though she were no longer the mistress of her own destiny, and as though she feared a fresh triumph. She knew that the Comte de Chagny, to please his brother, had done his best on her behalf with Monsieur Richard, and she wrote to thank him, and also to ask him to cease speaking in her favour. A reason for this curious attitude was never known. Some pretended that it was due to overweening pride. Others spoke of her heavenly modesty. But people on the stage are not so modest as all that, and I think that I shall not be far from the truth if I ascribe her action simply to fear. Yes, I believe that Christine Daae was frightened by what had happened to her. I have a letter of Christine's. It forms part of the Persian's collection relating to this period, which suggests a feeling of absolute dismay. "I don't know myself when I sing," writes the poor child. She showed herself nowhere, and the Vicomte de Chagny tried in vain to meet her. He wrote to her, asking to call upon her, but despaired of receiving a reply when, one morning, she sent him the following note. "Monsieur, I have not forgotten the little boy who went into the sea to rescue my scarf. I feel that I must write to you today, when I am going to Perrault, in fulfilment of a sacred duty. Tomorrow is the anniversary of the death of my poor father, whom you knew and who was very fond of you. He is buried there, with his violin, in the graveyard of the little church at the bottom of the slope where we used to play as children, beside the road where, when we were a little bigger, we said good-bye for the last time." The Vicomte de Chagny hurriedly consulted a railway guide, dressed as quickly as he could, wrote a few lines for his valet to take to his brother, and jumped into a cab which brought him to the Gare Montparnasse just in time to miss the morning train.
He spent a dismal day in town and did not recover his spirits until the evening, when he was seated in his compartment in the Brittany Express. He read Christine's note over and over again, smelling its perfume, recalling the sweet pictures of his childhood, and spent the rest of that tedious night journey in feverish dreams that began and ended with Christine Daae. Day was breaking when he alighted at Lannion. He hurried to the diligence for Perrault-Guirec. He was the only passenger. He questioned the driver and learned that, on the evening of the previous day, a young lady who looked like a Parisian had gone to Perrault and put up at the inn known as the Setting Sun. The nearer he drew to her, the more fondly he remembered the story of the little Swedish singer. Most of the details are still unknown to the public. There was once, in a little market town not far from Uppsala, a peasant who lived there with his family, digging the earth during the week and singing in the choir on Sundays. This peasant had a little daughter to whom he taught the musical alphabet before she knew how to read. Daae's father was a great musician, perhaps without knowing it. Not a fiddler throughout the length and breadth of Scandinavia played as he did. His reputation was widespread, and he was always invited to set the couples dancing at weddings and other festivals. His wife died when Christine was entering upon her sixth year. Then the father, who cared only for his daughter and his music, sold his patch of ground and went to Uppsala in search of fame and fortune. He found nothing but poverty. He returned to the country, wandering from fair to fair, strumming his Scandinavian melodies, while his child, who never left his side, listened to him in ecstasy or sang to his playing. One day, at Liemby Fair, Professor Valerius heard them and took them to Gothenburg. He maintained that the father was the first violinist in the world, and that the daughter had the making of a great artist. Her education and instruction were provided for. She made rapid progress and charmed everybody with her prettiness, her grace of manner, and her genuine eagerness to please. When Valerius and his wife went to settle in France, they took Daae and Christine with them. Mama Valerius treated Christine as her daughter. As for Daae, he began to pine away with homesickness. He never went out of doors in Paris, but lived in a sort of dream which he kept up with his violin. For hours at a time he remained locked up in his bedroom with his daughter, fiddling and singing very, very softly. Sometimes Mama Valerius would come and listen behind the door, wipe away a tear and go downstairs again on tiptoe, sighing for her Scandinavian skies. Daae seemed not to recover his strength until the summer, when the whole family went to stay at Perrault-Guirec in a faraway corner of Brittany, where the sea was of the same colour as in his own country. Often he would play his saddest tunes on the beach, and pretend that the sea stopped its roaring to listen to them. And then he induced Mama Valerius to indulge a queer whim of his. At the time of the pardons, or Breton pilgrimages, the village festival, and dances, he went off with his fiddle, as in the old days, and was allowed to take his daughter with him for a week. They gave the smallest hamlets music to last them for a year, and slept at night in a barn, refusing a bed at the inn, lying close together on the straw, as when they were so poor in Sweden. At the same time, they were very neatly dressed, made no collection, refused the halfpence offered them, and the people around could not understand the conduct of this rustic fiddler who tramped the roads with that pretty child who sang like an angel from heaven. They followed them from village to village. One day, a little boy who was out with his governess made her take a longer walk than he intended, for he could not tear himself from the little girl whose pure, sweet voice seemed to bind him to her. They came to the shore of an inlet, which is still called Trestrau, but which now, I believe, harbours a casino or something of the sort. At that time there was nothing but sky and sea and a stretch of golden beach. Only there was also a high wind, which blew Christine's scarf out to sea. Christine gave a cry and put out her arms, but the scarf was already far on the waves. Then she heard a voice say, "It's all right. I'll go and fetch your scarf out of the sea." And she saw a little boy running fast, in spite of the outcries and the indignant protests of a worthy lady in black. The little boy ran into the sea, dressed as he was, and brought back her scarf. Boy and scarf were both soaked through. The lady in black made a great fuss, but Christine laughed merrily and kissed the little boy, who was none other than the Vicomte Raoul de Chagny, staying at Lannion with his aunt. During the season, they saw each other and played together almost every day.
At the aunt's request, seconded by Professor Valerius, Daae consented to give the young Viscount some violin lessons. In this way, Raoul learned to love the same airs that had charmed Christine's childhood. They also both had the same calm and dreamy little cast of mind. They delighted in stories, in old Breton legends, and their favourite sport was to go and ask for them at the cottage doors, like beggars. "Ma'am," or "Kind gentleman, have you a little story to tell us, please?" And it seldom happened that they did not have one given them, for nearly every old Breton grandame has, at least once in her life, seen the Corrigans dance by moonlight on the heather. But their great treat was, in the twilight, in the great silence of the evening, after the sun had set in the sea, when Daae came and sat down by them on the roadside, and in a low voice, as though fearing lest he should frighten the ghosts whom he loved, told them the legends of the land of the north, and, the moment he stopped, the children would ask for more. There was one story that began, "A king sat in a little boat on one of those deep, still lakes that open like a bright eye in the midst of the Norwegian mountains." And another, "Little Lottie thought of everything and nothing. Her hair was golden as the sun's rays, and her soul as clear and blue as her eyes. She wheedled her mother, was kind to her doll, took great care of her frock and her little red shoes and her fiddle, but most of all loved, when she went to sleep, to hear the angel of music." While the old man told this story, Raoul looked at Christine's blue eyes and golden hair, and Christine thought that Lottie was very lucky to hear the angel of music when she went to sleep. The angel of music played a part in all Daddy Daae's tales, and he maintained that every great musician, every great artist, received a visit from the angel at least once in his life. Sometimes the angel leans over their cradle, as happened to Lottie, and that is how there are little prodigies who play the fiddle at 6 better than men at 50, which, you must admit, is very wonderful. Sometimes the angel comes much later, because the children are naughty and won't learn their lessons or practice their scales. And sometimes he does not come at all, because the children have a bad heart or a bad conscience. No one ever sees the angel, but he is heard by those who are meant to hear him. He often comes when they least expect him, when they are sad and disheartened. Then their ears suddenly perceive celestial harmonies, a divine voice which they remember all their lives. Persons who are visited by the angel quiver with a thrill unknown to the rest of mankind, and they cannot touch an instrument or open their mouths to sing without producing sounds that put all other human sounds to shame. Then people who do not know that the angel has visited those persons say that they have genius. Little Christine asked her father if he had heard the angel of music, but Daddy Daae shook his head sadly, and then his eyes lit up as he said, "You will hear him one day, my child. When I am in heaven, I will send him to you." Daddy was beginning to cough at that time. 3 years later, Raoul and Christine met again at Perrault. Professor Valerius was dead, but his widow remained in France with Daddy Daae and his daughter, who continued to play the violin and sing, wrapping in their dream of harmony their kind patroness, who seemed henceforth to live on music alone. The young man, as he now was, had come to Perrault on the chance of finding them, and went straight to the house in which they used to stay. He first saw the old man, and then Christine entered, carrying the tea tray. She flushed at the sight of Raoul, who went up to her and kissed her. She asked him a few questions, performed her duties as hostess prettily, took up the tray again and left the room. Then she ran into the garden and took refuge on a bench, a prey to feelings that stirred her young heart for the first time. Raoul followed her, and they talked till the evening very shyly. They were quite changed, cautious as two diplomatists, and told each other things that had nothing to do with their budding sentiments. When they took leave of each other by the roadside, Raoul, pressing a kiss on Christine's trembling hand, said, "Mademoiselle, I shall never forget you." And he went away regretting his words, for he knew that Christine could not be the wife of the Vicomte de Chagny. As for Christine, she tried not to think of him and devoted herself wholly to her art. She made wonderful progress, and those who heard her prophesied that she would be the greatest singer in the world. Meanwhile, the father died, and suddenly she seemed to have lost, with him, her voice,
her soul and her genius. She retained just, but only just, enough of this to enter the conservatoire, where she did not distinguish herself at all, attending classes without enthusiasm, and taking a prize only to please old Mama Valerius, with whom she continued to live. The first time that Raoul saw Christine at the opera, he was charmed by the girl's beauty and by the sweet images of the past which it evoked, but was rather surprised at the negative side of her art. He returned to listen to her. He followed her in the wings. He waited for her behind a Jacob's ladder. He tried to attract her attention. More than once he walked after her to the door of her box, but she did not see him. She seemed, for that matter, to see nobody. She was all indifference. Raoul suffered, for she was very beautiful, and he was shy, and dared not to confess his love, even to himself. And then came the lightning flash of the gala performance, the heavens torn asunder, and an angel's voice heard upon earth for the delight of mankind and the utter capture of his heart. And then there was that man's voice behind the door. "You must love me," and no one in the room. Why did she laugh when he reminded her of the incident of the scarf? Why did she not recognize him? And why had she written to him? Perrault was reached at last. Raoul walked into the smoky sitting-room of the setting sun, and at once saw Christine standing before him, smiling and showing no astonishment. "So you have come," she said. "I felt that I should find you here when I came back from Mass. Someone told me so at the church." "Who?" asked Raoul, taking her little hand in his. "Why, my poor father, who is dead." There was a silence, and then Raoul asked, "Did your father tell you that I love you, Christine, and that I cannot live without you?" Christine blushed to the eyes and turned away her head. In a trembling voice she said, "Me? You are dreaming, my friend." And she burst out laughing to put herself in countenance. "Don't laugh, Christine. I am quite serious," Raoul answered. And she replied gravely, "I did not make you come to tell me such things as that." "You made me come, Christine. You knew that your letter would not leave me indignant, and that I should hasten to Perrault. How can you have thought that if you did not think I loved you?" "I thought you would remember our games here as children, in which my father so often joined. I really don't know what I thought. Perhaps I was wrong to write to you. This anniversary and your sudden appearance in my room at the opera the other evening reminded me of the time long past and made me write to you as the little girl that I then was." There was something in Christine's attitude that seemed to Raoul not natural. He did not feel any hostility in her, far from it. The distressed affection shining in her eyes told him that. But why was this affection distressed? That was what he wished to know, and what was irritating him. "When you saw me in your dressing-room, was that the first time you noticed me, Christine?" She was incapable of lying. "No," she said. "I had seen you several times in your brother's box, and also on the stage."
"I thought so," said Raoul, compressing his lips. "But then why, when you saw me in your room, at your feet, reminding you that I had rescued your scarf from the sea, why did you answer as though you did not know me, and also why did you laugh?"
The tone of these questions was so rough that Christine stared at Raoul without replying. The young man himself was aghast at the sudden quarrel which he had dared to raise at the very moment when he had resolved to speak words of gentleness, love, and submission to Christine. A husband, a lover with all rights, would talk no differently to a wife, a mistress, who had offended him. But he had gone too far, and saw no other way out of the ridiculous position than to behave odiously.
"You don't answer," he said angrily and unhappily. "Well, I will answer for you. It was because there was someone in the room who was in your way, Christine, someone that you did not wish to know that you could be interested in anyone else."
"If anyone was in my way, my friend," Christine broke in coldly, "if anyone was in my way that evening, it was yourself, since I told you to leave the room."
"Yes, so that you might remain with the other."
"What are you saying, monsieur?" asked the girl excitedly. "And to what other do you refer?"
"To the man to whom you said, 'I sing only for you. Tonight I gave you my soul, and I am dead.'"
Christine seized Raoul's arm and clutched it with a strength which no one would have suspected in so frail a creature.
"Then you were listening behind the door?"
"Yes, because I love you, and I heard everything."
"You heard what?"
and the young girl, becoming strangely calm, released Raoul's arm. "He said to you, 'Christine, you must love me.'" At these words, a deathly pallor spread over Christine's face. Dark rings formed round her eyes. She staggered and seemed on the point of swooning. Raoul darted forward with arms outstretched, but Christine had overcome her passing faintness and said in a low voice, "Go on. Go on. Tell me all you heard." At an utter loss to understand, Raoul answered, "I heard him reply when you said you had given him your soul. 'Your soul is a beautiful thing, child, and I thank you. No emperor ever received so fair a gift. The angels wept tonight.'" Christine carried her hand to her heart, a prey to indescribable emotion. Her eyes stared before her like a madwoman's. Raoul was terror-stricken. But suddenly Christine's eyes moistened and two great tears trickled like two pearls down her ivory cheeks. "Christine! Raoul!" The young man tried to take her in his arms, but she escaped and fled in great disorder. While Christine remained locked in her room, Raoul was at his wit's end what to do. He refused to breakfast. He was terribly concerned and bitterly grieved to see the hours, which he had hoped to find so sweet, slip past without the presence of the young Swedish girl. Why did she not come to Rome with him through the country where they had so many memories in common? He heard that she had had a mass said that morning for the repose of her father's soul, and spent a long time praying in the little church and on the fiddler's tomb. Then, as she seemed to have nothing more to do at Perrault, and, in fact, was doing nothing there, why did she not go back to Paris at once? Raoul walked away dejectedly to the graveyard in which the church stood, and was indeed alone among the tombs, reading the inscriptions. But when he turned behind the apse, he was suddenly struck by the dazzling note of the flowers that straggled over the white ground. They were marvellous red roses that had blossomed in the morning in the snow, giving a glimpse of life among the dead, for death was all around him. It also, like the flowers, issued from the ground, which had flung back a number of its corpses. Skeletons and skulls by the hundred were heaped against the wall of the church, held in position by a wire that left the whole gruesome stack visible. Dead men's bones, arranged in rows like bricks, to form the first course upon which the walls of the sacristy had been built. The door of the sacristy opened in the middle of that bony structure, as is often seen in old Breton churches. Raoul said a prayer for Daae, and then, painfully impressed by all those eternal smiles on the mouths of skulls, he climbed the slope and sat down on the edge of the heath overlooking the sea. The wind fell with the evening. Raoul was surrounded by icy darkness, but he did not feel the cold. It was here, he remembered, that he used to come with little Christine to see the Corrigans dance at the rising of the moon. He had never seen any, though his eyes were good, whereas Christine, who was a little short-sighted, pretended that she had seen many. He smiled at the thought, and then suddenly gave a start. A voice behind him said, "Do you think the Corrigans will come this evening?" It was Christine. He tried to speak. She put her gloved hand on his mouth. "Listen, Raoul, I have decided to tell you something serious, very serious. Do you remember the legend of the Angel of Music?" "I do indeed," he said. "I believe it was here that your father first told it to us." "And it was here that he said, 'When I am in heaven, my child, I will send him to you.' Well, Raoul, my father is in heaven, and I have been visited by the Angel of Music." "I have no doubt of it," replied the young man gravely, for it seemed to him that his friend, in obedience to a pious thought, was connecting the memory of her father and the brilliancy of her last triumph. Christine appeared astonished at the Vicomte de Chagny's coolness. "How do you understand it?" she asked, bringing her pale face so close to his that he might have thought that Christine was going to give him a kiss. But she only wanted to read his eyes in spite of the dark. "I understand," he said, "that no human being can sing as you sang the other evening without the intervention of some miracle. No professor on earth can teach you such accents as those. You have heard the Angel of Music, Christine." "Yes," she said solemnly, "in my dressing room. That is where he comes to give me my lessons daily."
"In your dressing room?" he echoed stupidly.
"Yes, that is where I have heard him, and I have not been the only one to hear him."
"Who else heard him, Christine?"
"You, my friend."
"I?"
I heard the angel of music?
Yes. The other evening, it was he who was talking when you were listening behind the door. It was he who said, you must love me. But I then thought that I was the only one to hear his voice. Imagine my astonishment when you told me this morning that you could hear him too.
Raoul burst out laughing. The first rays of the moon came and shrouded the two young people in their light. Christine turned on Raoul with a hostile air. Her eyes, usually so gentle, flashed fire.
What are you laughing at? You think you heard a man's voice, I suppose.
Well, replied the young man, whose ideas began to grow confused in the face of Christine's determined attitude.
It's you, Raoul, who say that? You, an old playfellow of my own, a friend of my father's? But you have changed since those days. What are you thinking of? I am an honest girl, Monsieur Vicomte de Chagny, and I don't lock myself up in my dressing room with men's voices. If you had opened the door, you would have seen that there was nobody in the room.
That's true. I did open the door when you were gone, and I found no one in the room.
So you see? Well?
The Viscount summoned up all his courage.
Well, Christine,
I think that somebody is making game of you. She gave a cry and ran away. He ran after her, but in a tone of fierce anger she called out,
Leave me! Leave me!
And she disappeared. Raoul returned to the inn feeling very weary, very low-spirited, and very sad. He was told that Christine had gone to her bedroom, saying that she would not be down to dinner. Raoul dined alone, in a very gloomy mood. Then he went to his room and tried to read, went to bed and tried to sleep. There was no sound in the next room. The hours passed slowly. It was about 11:30 when he distinctly heard someone moving with a light, stealthy step in the room next to his. Then Christine had not gone to bed. Without troubling for a reason, Raoul dressed, taking care not to make a sound, and waited. Waited for what? How could he tell? But his heart thumped in his chest when he heard Christine's door turn slowly on its hinges. Where could she be going at this hour when everyone was fast asleep at Perrault? Softly opening the door, he saw Christine's white form in the moonlight slipping along the passage. She went down the stairs, and he leaned over the baluster above her. Suddenly he heard two voices in rapid conversation. He caught one sentence, "Don't lose the key." It was the landlady's voice. The door facing the sea was opened and locked again, then all was still. Raoul ran back to his room and threw back the window. Christine's white form stood on the deserted quay. The first floor of the setting sun was at no great height, and a tree growing against the wall held out its branches to Raoul's impatient arms and enabled him to climb down unknown to the landlady. Her amazement, therefore, was all the greater when, the next morning, the young man was brought back to her half-frozen, more dead than alive, and when she learned that he had been found stretched at full length on the steps of the high altar of the little church. She ran at once to tell Christine, who hurried down and, with the help of the landlady, did her best to revive him. He soon opened his eyes and was not long in recovering when he saw his friend's charming face leaning over him. A few weeks later, when the tragedy at the opera compelled the intervention of the public prosecutor, Monsieur Mifroy, the commissary of police, examined the Vicomte de Chagny touching the events of the night at Perrault. I quote the questions and answers as given in the official report, pages 150, etc. Question. Did Mademoiselle Daae not see you come down from your room by the curious road which you selected? Response. No, monsieur, no. Although when walking behind her, I took no pains to deaden the sound of my footsteps. In fact, I was anxious that she should turn round and see me. I realized that I had no excuse for following her, and that this way of spying on her was unworthy of me. But she seemed not to hear me, and acted exactly as though I were not there. She quietly left the quay, and then suddenly walked quickly up the road. The church clock had struck 11:45, and I thought that this must have made her hurry, for she began almost to run, and continued hastening until she came to the church. Question. Was the gate open? Response. Yes, monsieur, and this surprised me, but did not seem to surprise Mademoiselle Daae. Question. Was there no one in the churchyard? Response. I did not see anyone, and if there had been, I must have seen him. The moon was shining on the snow, and made the night quite light. Question. Was it possible for anyone to hide behind the tombstones? Response. No, monsieur. They were quite small, poor tombstones, partly hidden under the snow, with their crosses just above the level of the ground. The only shadows were those of the crosses and ourselves. The church stood out quite brightly. I never saw so clear a night. It was very fine and very cold, and one could see everything.
Question. Are you at all superstitious?
Response. No, monsieur. I am a practicing Catholic.
Question. In what condition of mind were you?
Response. Very healthy and peaceful, I assure you. Mademoiselle Daye's curious action in going out at that hour had worried me at first, but as soon as I saw her go to the churchyard, I thought that she meant to fulfill some pious duty on her father's grave, and I considered this so natural that I recovered all my calmness. I was only surprised that she had not heard me walking behind her, for my footsteps were quite audible on the hard snow. But she must have been taken up with her intentions, and I resolved not to disturb her. She knelt down by her father's grave, made the sign of the cross, and began to pray. At that moment it struck midnight. At the last stroke I saw Mademoiselle Daye lift her eyes to the sky and stretch out her arms as though in ecstasy. I was wondering what the reason could be, when I myself raised my head and everything within me seemed drawn toward the invisible, which was playing the most perfect music. Christine and I knew that music. We had heard it as children. But it had never been executed with such divine art, even by Monsieur Daye. I remembered all that Christine had told me of the angel of music. The air was The Resurrection of Lazarus, which old Mr. Daye used to play to us in his hours of melancholy and of faith. If Christine's angel had existed, he could not have played better that night on the late musician's violin. When the music stopped, I seemed to hear a noise from the skulls in the heap of bones. It was as though they were chuckling, and I could not help shuddering.
Question. Did it not occur to you that the musician might be hiding behind that very heap of bones?
Response. It was the one thought that did occur to me, monsieur, so much so that I omitted to follow Mademoiselle Daye when she stood up and walked slowly to the gate. She was so much absorbed just then that I am not surprised that she did not see me.
Question.
Then what happened that you were found in the morning lying half dead on the steps of the high altar?
Response.
First a skull rolled to my feet, then another, then another. It was as if I were the mark of that ghastly game of bowls, and I had an idea that false step must have destroyed the balance of the structure behind which our musician was concealed. This surmise seemed to be confirmed when I saw a shadow suddenly glide along the sacristy wall. I ran up. The shadow had already pushed open the door and entered the church, but I was quicker than the shadow and caught hold of a corner of its cloak. At that moment we were just in front of the high altar, and the moonbeams fell straight upon us through the stained-glass windows of the apse. As I did not let go of the cloak, the shadow turned round, and I saw a terrible death's head which darted a look at me from a pair of scorching eyes. I felt as if I were face to face with Satan, and in the presence of this unearthly apparition my heart gave way, my courage failed me, and I remember nothing more until I recovered consciousness of the setting sun.
Chapter 6. A Visit to Box 5.
We left Monsieur Firmin Richard and Monsieur Armand Moncharmin at the moment when they were deciding to look into that little matter of Box 5. Leaving behind them the broad staircase which leads from the lobby outside the manager's offices to the stage and its dependencies, they crossed the stage, went out by the subscriber's door, and entered the house through the first little passage on the left. Then they made their way through the front rows of stalls and looked at Box 5 on the grand tier. They could not see it well, because it was half in darkness, and because great covers were flung over the red velvet of the ledges of all the boxes. They were almost alone in the huge, gloomy house, and a great silence surrounded them. It was the time when most of the stagehands go out for a drink. The staff had left the boards for the moment, leaving a scene half set. A few rays of light, a wan, sinister light that seemed to have been stolen from an expiring luminary, fell through some opening or other upon an old tower that raised its pasteboard battlements on the stage. Everything in this deceptive light adopted a fantastic shape. In the orchestra stalls, the drugget covering them looked like an angry sea, whose glaucous waves had been suddenly rendered stationary by a secret order from the storm phantom, who, as everybody knows, is called Adamastor. Monsieur Moncharmin and Richard were the shipwrecked mariners amid this motionless turmoil of a calico sea. They made for the left boxes, ploughing their way like sailors who leave their ship and try to struggle to the shore. The eight great polished columns stood up in the dusk, like so many huge piles supporting the threatening, crumbling, big-bellied cliffs, whose layers were represented by the circular, parallel, waving lines of the balconies of the grand, first and second tiers of boxes. At the top, right on top of the cliff, lost in Monsieur Lenepveur's copper ceiling, figures grinned and grimaced, laughed and jeered at Monsieur Richard and Moncharmin's distress. And yet these figures were usually very serious. Their names were Isis, Amphitrite, Hebe, Pandora, Psyche, Thetis, Pomona, Daphne, Clytie, Galatea, and Arethusa. Yes, Arethusa herself and Pandora, whom we all know by her box, looked down upon the two new managers of the opera, who ended by clutching at some piece of wreckage and from there stared silently at Box 5 on the grand tier. I have said that they were distressed. At least I presume so. Monsieur Moncharmin, in any case, admits that he was impressed. To quote his own words in his memoirs, "This moonshine about the opera ghost in which, since we first took over the duties of Messieurs Poligny and Debienne, we had been so nicely steeped, Moncharmin's style is not always irreproachable, had no doubt ended by blinding my imaginative and also my visual faculties. It may be that the exceptional surroundings in which we found ourselves, in the midst of an incredible silence, impressed us to an unusual extent. It may be that we were the sport of a kind of hallucination brought about by the semi-darkness of the theatre and the partial gloom that filled Box 5. At any rate, I saw, and Richard also saw, a shape in the box. Richard said nothing, nor I either. But we spontaneously seized each other's hand. We stood like that for some minutes, without moving, with our eyes fixed on the same point. But the figure had disappeared. Then we went out and, in the lobby, communicated our impressions to each other and talked about the shape. The misfortune was that my shape was not in the least like Richard's. I had seen a thing like a death's head resting on the ledge of the box, whereas Richard saw the shape of an old woman who looked like Mame Giry. We soon discovered that we had really been the victims of an illusion, whereupon, without further delay and laughing like madmen, we ran to Box 5 on the grand tier, went inside, and found no shape of any kind. Box 5 is just like all the other grand tier boxes. There is nothing to distinguish it from any of the others. Monsieur Moncharmin and Monsieur Richard, ostensibly highly amused and laughing at each other, moved the furniture of the box, lifted the cloths and the chairs, and particularly examined the armchair in which the man's voice used to sit. But they saw that it was a respectable armchair, with no magic about it. Altogether, the box was the most ordinary box in the world, with its red hangings, its chairs, its carpet, and its ledge covered in red velvet. After feeling that carpet in the most serious manner possible, and discovering nothing more here or anywhere else, they went down to the corresponding box on the pit tier below. In Box 5, in the pit tier, which is just inside the first exit from the stalls on the left, they found nothing worth mentioning either. "These people are all making fools of us," Firmin Richard ended by exclaiming. "It will be Faust on Saturday. Let us both see the performance from Box 5 on the grand tier." Chapter 7 Faust and What Followed. On the Saturday morning, on reaching their office, the joint managers found a letter from O.G. worded in these terms. "My dear managers, so it is to be war between us. If you still care for peace, here is my ultimatum. It consists of the four following conditions. 1. You must give me back my private box, and I wish it to be at my free disposal from henceforward. 2. The part of Margarita shall be sung this evening by Christine Daae. Never mind about Carlotta. She will be ill. 3. I absolutely insist upon the good and loyal services of Madame Giry, my boxkeeper, whom you will reinstate in her functions forthwith. 4. Let me know by a letter handed to Madame Giry, who will see that it reaches me, that you accept, as your predecessors did, the conditions in my memorandum book relating to my monthly allowance. I will inform you later how you are to pay it to me. If you refuse, you will give a Faust tonight in a house with a curse upon it. Take my advice and be warned in time. O.G.
Look here, I'm getting sick of him. Sick of him,
shouted Richard, bringing his fists down on